This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, you can always find heroes around you. Oftentimes, we have no idea to what lengths our neighbors have gone to secure the freedom we so easily take for granted. And here on Hometown Heroes, we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget or miss out on learning how heavy a price has been paid for our freedom as Americans. And along the way, we hear things that you might not hear anywhere else. We're educated, entertained, and sometimes even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And boy, do the stories from prisoners of war grab our attention. A rare occasion this time where we continue the last episode and the story of Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He and his wife, Ann, have enjoyed 66 years of marriage, but they never would have met if he hadn't survived more than 3 years in captivity. Here's where we left off. Bill had retreated from Bataan, avoiding the infamous death march when he boarded a boat for Corregidor. He was captured on the fortified island of Fort Hughes and taken to Corregidor in what was known as 92nd Garage. This is May of 1942. The 92nd Garage had been home to the motor pool for the 92nd Coast Artillery. That's where the name came from. And now this was where the Japanese were holding all their prisoners on Corregidor. Bill, you're 22 years old. I can't imagine the uncertainty and the fear you must have dealt with. How'd you deal with this new reality of being a prisoner of the Japanese?
Just day by day. If the Japanese gave us orders, we did it. If they didn't give orders, we just sat down and worried about food and water. We got the 92nd Garage. One of my buddies, it was the one that I was best man at his wedding. He had some GI rations. I said, "Where'd you get that?" He said, "Right over there. It's such and such, 92nd Garage." And I was as hungry as I could be. I hadn't eaten for 2 or 3 days. And I stood and looked at him, and he just kept eating. And finally I said, "Well, I hope the hell you choke to death." He didn't offer me a thing. Hmm. Our friendship ended right there. We separated. I never saw him again. He ended up at China, a big camp there that had about 2,000. One day the camp was bombed by American bombers, B-29s, that came over. One of the bombers bombed, hung up in the rack. They got over the prison camp, which was not far away. And the bomb came loose and went down, blew up, hit him. Mm. And just filled his lower body with shrapnel. And he didn't live a couple more days. That was the end of him. And getting back to 92nd Garage, I finally got guts enough to go over and steal some of our own GI rations. They had an area on the island of... You could go, and it was leftover stuff like blankets and shaving kits and all that kind of stuff that the Japs had taken from the soldiers. Well, I got a marine blanket. I thought, well, I don't know where we're going to end up, but I'm going to take this marine blanket. And I got a shaving kit, a Schick injector shaving kit that was laying there. I picked it up. It's in the medicine cabinet right now.
You still have it?
I still have it. I brought it back to where I was sleeping, and this other guy, he was there. Anyway, I went and got some cans of GI, had left it there while I'd gone over to get this blanket. I came back, and he was eating the darn cans. I said, that's the last time you're going to eat my food, and I separated from him. Hmm. So I was all alone, and we finally got on a ship, got on at 92nd Garage, went to Manila, got on a train, and they took us up in the northern part of Luzon to a prison camp called Camanatuan Camp 3. This was the fortified island's personnel, and I heard one officer say, "Well, we've got 6,000 men in this camp." So that's how many soldiers were captured in the fortified islands.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with Bataan and that deal. We were there until one day a Jap soldier came by and said, what did you do in civilian life? He addressed the whole camp. I finally wrote down, I said, carpenter. I had worked for Dad. I'd poured concrete. I'd hammered nails. Dad built some FHA GI houses here in Albuquerque, two batches of them, and I knew how to hammer nails. That's about all I knew. So I put down carpenter. I wasn't doing too good in college, so I didn't put down student. They wouldn't want to hear that. That note carried me all the way to Yokohama, Japan. And I went to work after we got to Japan. We walked 30 minutes every day from Yokohama to Mitsubishi Shipyard. Worked 10, 12 hours daylight to dark. And back 30 minutes past the Yokohama train station, they made me what they call a toritsuke. That's Japanese for carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
A ship's carpenter. Now, a ship's carpenter does a little bit different thing than wood carpenters. But I learned, and they trained me, and I looked at the blueprints one day, and it said U.S. of A. Again, they bought all their stuff, their steel, their blueprints, their method of building ships, battleships, everything they had. They were copying what mm-hmm. what we had done.
And what kinds of things were you doing? What were you working on?
I was working primarily out on the decks. The decks were flat on the ground. There were steel plates. There were hundreds of feet of steel plates laid flat on the dirt. They would take a 40-foot long beam and lay it down on a new steel plate, and then use U-clamps on top of that and a wedge, drive that wedge in there and make the steel beam and the steel plate tight like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had some Korean kids about 10 years old that were welders. They all wore yellow uniforms and they were prisoners of war like we were. And they would come with electric welding and they would tack weld that steel plate to that steel beam. And eventually that steel beam would end up on the ship. We worked on one ship. It was a tanker, an oil tanker. And it came in. We worked on it for over a year.
Wow.
Converting it to a small aircraft carrier. Then when we finished our work, they put it in the water, and it was right alongside the dock, tied to the docks. We walked to work one day and heard some explosions going on and planes flying. And man, we couldn't wait to get over to the shipyard and see what was happening. Six SB-2Cs, Navy dive bombers,
mm-hmm.
came in at sea level, rolled over, and sunk that ship right there at the harbor. And it was going glub, glub when we got there. Boy, we were yelling, I'll tell you. The Japs didn't kill any of us, but we were happy.
It's the one time in your life you were really glad that some of your work was destroyed, huh?
Right.
Right. Well, and along those lines, I'm sure a lot of folks at home are listening to this and wondering what that's like when you're working every day. And it sounds like pretty exhausting work. I'm sure they fed you just enough to keep you strong enough to do the work, and I'm sure you weren't treated luxuriously or anything, but you're doing this work day after day after day, and I'm sure there's something in the back of your head that says, I'm doing this, and this is going to be used against my country, my buddies, my military. Was that hard to deal with, and did you ever try to think, boy, is there somehow I could sabotage this somehow or do something to compromise the integrity of what it is we're working on here?
We had to face that every day. We had 300 men in our prison camp. We had 17 nationalities. But some of the guys were on different crews. I was a toritsuke. I worked one-on-one with the honcho. And some of the guys were welders, and some of them were riveters, four-man riveters. I remember hearing several guys say, well, I dropped the rivet gun today and it went into the water and I don't think they're going to find it. He was bragging on it. Mm-hmm. I don't blame him. That's good. We're supposed to do that. But if you're going to die, if you get caught, that's not so good.
That was my next question. Did you ever have a very real example or sense or understanding of what might happen to you if you were caught intentionally messing up the work that you were supposed to be doing?
Yes. I saw a couple guys that were, I don't know what happened at the shipyard, but they brought them back to the camp and they put them in a little tiny thing. It was about as big a square as this, or even smaller. One man would be in there. They couldn't sit down. They couldn't lay down. They had to stand up. They couldn't stand straight up. They were bent over like this, and they were in there for weeks. Mm. Weeks. And we'd have snow at night, and they didn't have anything to keep them warm. Too bad. Too bad. In fact, towards the end of the war, I had a narrow point of view in some respects about how to do the work. And I'd tell them, well, talk to my honcho, and I'd say, let's don't do it this way. Let's do it this way. Turn it over this way and try it and do it this way. And it's so much easier. Nye, nye, nye. No, no, Jirosha, nye. Baquero. And we're not going to do that. We're going to do it the Japanese way. And if we don't do it that way, we're going to die. And it's the way they did it. Mm-hmm. They would die if they couldn't do it. One day, my honcho took me to the main honcho. He tried to talk to me, and I said, nye, nye, let's turn it over. And that set him off. Fujiyama was his name. And he came at me with a cold chisel. Now, they use cold chisels to write on the deck. And they use a chalk to write out things. And this blows up on the deck. And put it with such and such and so on and so forth. American writers would tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. And then they would use this cold chisel and they'd write that same thing and dent it into the metal.
Right.
Well, this big honcho, he had gotten the word from the little honcho about me not wanting to do it the right way. Mm-hmm. So he came at me and it surprised me. He tried to stab me with his cold chisel. It was sharp. It got over my shoulder and broke the back and broke the skin. It wasn't very bad, but it was enough to break the skin. So I just reached up and grabbed his hands. He looked at me, and I looked at him, and finally I just turned him loose, and he backed up a little bit, and I said to myself, Bill, you've gone too far. And here came a guy that was over there on the deck. He was about 100 yards off. He heard all the talking going on. I didn't understand the Japanese, but he did. He was a Jap. And he came over, and he slugged me right in the face, knocked me down, and it didn't hurt me that much. I finally just got up and stood there again. They turned around and walked away. Hmm. They had saved face. And I never realized that that would happen. I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought I was going to get it all. But I didn't. They released me, and I went back to work the next day, and everything was all right.
Wow. I can't imagine anyone listening to this and not being absolutely terrified, just imagining some of the things you're describing here. In general, how did the Japanese treat you? What was life like in the prison camp when you weren't working? Did you have anything to eat? What, can you paint a picture of that existence? Because this is more than 3 years of your life. You lived in captivity. What was it like?
We worked 9 days and got the 10th day off. Now, fleas and lice were rampant. You cannot believe going through life with insects crawling inside your clothes. We spent the day off taking our clothes off, turning them inside out, finding first the lice. They didn't jump, but we could catch them and pop them between our thumbnails. Well, later on, it turned into fleas. we'd find a flea, and by the time we'd start to pop him, well, he'd jump. We'd never catch him. Mm-hmm. But we slept on a straw mat. It was raised up off of the floor, and that's where they came from, I guess. We didn't know where they were. Anyway, we would repair our clothes if you had a needle and thread. And if you didn't have anything else to do, you'd play cards. If you had a deck of cards, you could play bridge. And I got a hold of a book. It was more than maybe a half a dozen books in the whole 300 camp.
But you got your hands on one of them, and I want you to share why that was so significant and what it meant to you. But we need to catch a break here. 94-year-old Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico, our guest. You'll find some photos of him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You'll even see Bill throwing out the first pitch at a baseball game just last month. The rest of this prisoner of war story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 94-year-old ex-prisoner of war Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. When we left off, Bill was saying that he got his hands on a book, and there weren't too many books around this Japanese prison camp. It sounds like pretty dry subject matter. It was a book on all the rules of bridge, the card game. But Bill, it sounds like it wasn't about what was in the book, but the opportunity for that book to keep your mind stimulated. Is that right?
I got that book, and I started memorizing. The diet was so bad that we were worried that our minds were going bad, too. And maybe we were justified. We didn't know. But I started memorizing 30 minutes to walk and 30 minutes back, and I memorized that whole book.
Wow.
We played bridge with the Portuguese subjects, British subjects, bank tellers. Mm-hmm. That's what they did. We didn't stand a chance because we used the same system that the book was, and they used the eclectic system. They made it up on their own, and they'd say three clubs, and the partner say four diamonds and five no trump, and they'd bid it and make it, and we kept a perpetual score, and we got 10,000 points behind. But we still played. We loved it.
Well, it kept your minds going, huh?
We would get a chance to shower, and they had these little wooden bins about like this, oval shape, with fresh water in them. And we would pour one of those over us and then soap up, and then we'd take another one and pour over to wash the soap off. Then we would go get into a hot tub. It was a hot tub with walls about this high, and it was about this big around, circular. And it had a pipe in it and a steam. It would go tick, 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 tick. And that pipe would heat that water. Hmm. They'd heat it almost boiling hot. Man. It was so darn hot that sometimes you'd hesitate to getting in. Hmm. We loved it. If your turn was early, you got into that, it was clean water. if it was number 300, you got into soup. It was the dirtiest looking stuff you ever saw. These other guys, instead of washing with soap and water, they'd say, well, I can't wait. They'd get in. Hmm. And they'd get the wash off in the steam water. The food was bad. We had three meals a day. We had grain. First of all, we had wheat, and they'd make biscuits. And, we loved those. But they didn't last more than a couple months. And then we were on rice. Used rice, white rice, barley, korea. We called it korea. It was a reddish colored grain, and we didn't know what it was, and soybeans, and that was it. We didn't know what it was. It was keeping us alive, but everybody met the diet, unless you worked in the kitchen or something like that, and you got all you wanted, and we never got that. We had two meals a day, the breakfast and supper, and it was that grain, and that's all it was.
And not large quantities, I'm sure.
Oh, no. Everybody got the same ration. We had one man that was captured late in camp, and he was a subject from Ireland and one of the naval companies. He was captured on a naval ship, and he had the best build on him. It was just like a bodybuilder today that you have seen. Man, he looked beautiful. In 6 months, he was dead. He couldn't adjust to that diet. Mm-hmm. And it was a case of adjusting. I got down to 60 kilos or even less, which is 132 pounds. But I had not lost the weight that, say, a six-footer or anybody that weighed over that weight, you know. Either you adjust or you don't. But we had many diseases. Beriberi was one of them. Pellagra was another, and a lot of guys had malaria, and it was just unbelievable. We got out to the shipyard. We got lunch out there. Have you ever eaten fish head soup?
No, I've heard about it. Sounds delightful.
Well, it's not delightful, but you eat it. Eggs, eyes, and all. Mm-hmm. When you're out there and you're hungry, and we found out later, indirectly, that the native people were not eating any better than we were. Mm. But we knew the guards were eating better than we were, because they would not eat anything but white rice. Mm. They wouldn't eat soybeans and any of the rest. Soybeans are what kept us alive. The protein from those soybeans kept us alive. We didn't know it. Most of us didn't even have any ideas, but that's what did. But we were hungry all the time. And we lived thinking about what we were going to eat when we got home. It just, you cannot believe some of the menus that these guys came up with and wrote them out.
I've had POWs tell me that before. The imaginary restaurants they were going to eat at. For you, it must have been, what would it have been, green chili or red chili you were craving?
No, ice cream and cake and all that, desserts, and I still love them, boy.
I bet you do. Did your family have any idea what had become of you? Did they know you were a POW?
Eventually. I finally got a letter from my aunt, who was a farmer back in Illinois, and she wrote a letter. It was just like, you can't believe, hope from home, and we got a Red Cross parcel when we were in camp. We got I think we got 2.5 Red Cross parcels in 3 years. We looked forward to those parcels. You can't believe how we relished those things.
And the Japanese actually gave you everything that was in it?
Yes, the whole thing. That was unbelievable. I've heard stories about otherwise. But finally, I got a parcel from home. In the camp, it's a case of existence in another city or town or whatever. We had officers in the camp that made the rules. They didn't have to go to work. We were jealous of that. But we had guys that would trade their food off for cigarettes. Cigarettes was a mode of money.
Currency, yeah.
Currency. He had such an appetite for smoking that he would give up. Well, finally, the officers declared him bankrupt. And no longer could you trade cigarettes for his rice. And he finally started eating again. I guess he survived. But towards the end, we started getting a little ration of fish. We got whale meat. My first experience with a mammal, ocean going. And shrimp. We got shrimp and crab meat and stuff like that. Some of it was pretty darn good. We looked forward to it. And we even got some fruit, finally. We had some fruit. We didn't know what it was. They had their own name. And I still don't know. It's a cross between an apple and a pear or something like that. But we ate it. Boy, we'd eat anything we could get. Anything. There were no dogs. There were no cats. There was no anything around that was edible. We ate it.
I believe it. I know it's hard to answer some of these questions I ask in situations like this, but the thing that strikes me is when you're in that situation and you have no idea what the expiration date is, you have no idea when this war is going to be over, no idea whether you'll survive this prison camp, die in captivity. How did you remain hopeful? How did you continue to believe that you would be a free man again someday, that you'd get back to America someday? What was it that kept you going and kept you believing?
There was a Japanese newspaper, and I don't know where it came from. Working at a shipyard, it had sources that I was not aware of. I never did learn. Some guys brought in pure alcohol in their pants leg in a jar and drank alcohol and got drunk. I never got any of it. Anyway, we had a couple of guys in the camp that could read a Japanese newspaper. The Japanese newspaper had three languages. It had one called katagana and one hiragana and then kanji. Mm-hmm. The kanji part was the Chinese hen-scratching, we called it. And if you could read that, the katagana and the hiragana had something like 28 or 38 characters in it. It was like our alphabet, only longer. And then put that together with the kanji, and you could read it. But we had difficulty locating the maps on the paper where the activity, the war, was going on. But we also relied on rumors and scuttlebutt and everything else. But one day, a flight of bombers, American bombers, they weren't B-17s. They were B-29s. We had never seen a plane that big. Mm-hmm. It was as big as to carry, I think the capacity was something like five times bigger than a B-17.
Well, and when you went overseas, B-17 was the biggest thing flying. They hadn't even really been making B-24s yet, let alone B-29s.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And all they did was drop propaganda. And we saw some of it. And the Japs, they didn't like it. They didn't want us to read that stuff. And we still got some. But that's hope. Boy, when you're seeing those planes up there, mm-hmm. they're coming over and they're going back home. They're not getting shot down. One night we spent, later on, a night in the slit trenches again, and 400 of those babies came over. 400 B-29s! Now, Fujiyama is off to the west of Yokohama, and we see it every day on a clear day. Snow on it, beautiful peak mountain.
We've all seen that beautiful mountain, sure.
The planes came in at night over Fujiyama and made a 90 over our camp and went over Tokyo and dropped gasoline bombs. And the searchlights were hitting each one of those planes. They were single file, and they're only about 1,000 yards. They were not up high.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, uh-oh, they're going to get it from the anti-aircraft. They're going to get it from the Zeros. Well, the Zeros, two Zeros would take the first one. He'd knock off the tail gunner, and then the other guy would sit back there and pump lead in until the tanks caught on fire. And then we'd see the plane start slipping away from the fire, and they'd get out over the ocean. We knew, we saw seven of them. I saw seven of them. They were on fire, and they never got home, and I doubt if they ever made it, because they fell in the ocean, and who's going to pick them up that close to Japan? Anyway, Zeros would take the first plane, and anti-aircraft would take the second one, and the Zeros would take the third one, and so forth. I said, well, why don't our planes shoot back? They've got machine guns in those B-29s. We never did see any machine gun. Oh, yeah, there's one. There he's shooting back. His tracers were a real bright red, and the Japanese were a dark red, so we could tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But we found out later that they scuttled all of those planes so they could put more bombs in and load the bombs. When we left, we knew that the Japs knew that they were going to hit Yokohama Shipyard. And the last 6 months, they moved us north to Sendai. And we saw Tokyo. And it's just like this table.
Flattened.
Just like this table. Mm. Paper houses, wooden houses. There was one church, had a chimney sticking up, but it was masonry.
Mm-hmm.
And it could take it. But they dropped these bombs, and then they'd bring one plane in with HE, and it would take those fires and blow them a city block.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the most effective thing you ever saw. And we knew things were coming to an end.
Well, and I want to hear about that, but it's time for our final break. We'll get the final chapter of Bill Overmeyer's extraordinary story, including what it felt like after 1,227 days in captivity to become a free man again. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Attention, veterans of all ages. Next Saturday is all about you. Next Saturday, May 17th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District Building, it is Military Appreciation Day. Bring your family. They'll have a bounce house, ponies, even square dancers. And if you're a veteran, you'll get a free lunch, even a free haircut if you want one. Whether you served 70 years ago or you're in our armed forces today, the Central Valley wants to thank you for your service on Military Appreciation Day. Looking for a job? Several top-notch employers will be there as part of the Health, Job, and Resource Fairs. It's Saturday, May 17th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, call 431-1985. That's 431-1985. Military Appreciation Day, our chance to tell all you veterans thank you for serving our country.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a two-part interview with 94-year-old Bill Overmeyer of Albuquerque, New Mexico. When we left off, he'd been moved yet again from a prison camp near Yokohama to one in the Sendai area, Sendai 2B Yoshima in northern Japan. He'd been staying in what had been dormitories for coal mine workers there. You said when you passed through Tokyo and saw the aftermath of the firebombing there that you had a feeling the end was near. But you're still a prisoner. Tell me about those final few months of captivity in Sendai.
I soon found out I didn't like coal mines. So I managed to get on the Yama party. Yama is mountain in Japanese. And if you on the Yama party, you go out in the morning and you tear up a trees, little scrub trees, the bushes, the weeds, the rocks, and get it ready for them to plant a garden on the side of the mountain or whatever. One day, we was on the Yama party, and the guard came to us and said, Bakudan, Toksan. Bakudan, Toksan. We said, Bakudan, well, that's a bomber. And Toksan is big. Yeah, that's pretty big. Must have been a blockbuster. We didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And until We were recaptured. We found out about atomic bombs. And it was the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. What it was.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
How was it that you were liberated? And what was that glorious day like for you?
Well, we had the same problem eating what little there was to eat at this prison camp. One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school.
Huh.
And he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, "Peace is smiling." We said, "What'd you say?" "Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo." Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, "Don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please." We said, "Yes, we will." Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp. A camp of 55 drums of cocoa, 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else. And boy, we started eating like you can't believe. And I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on a straw mattress. And he had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years, and he got, at least he didn't suffer.
Here they're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
It did happen.
When you think about that, and I have a few more questions for you, but there's as good a moment as any to bring this up, because I've just been listening to you here, Bill, for quite a few minutes of this conversation, and you've described all these things where your life was almost taken. A decision you made or just a chance occurrence spared your life. And there are probably enough of those that you've lost count over all that time before and after you were captured. And then something like that when you're being liberated and here's another friend of yours that gets killed in that tragic moment. Now you look back, you're 94, you've been married for 66 years, you never would have met Ann, you've got 5 kids, 9 grandkids, 9 great-grandkids, 23 people who would have never been born. How do you account for all that? How do you make that make sense with everything that could have happened to you and almost did?
It doesn't make sense, but all you can do is say, I think I was lucky. I was fortunate in the outcome of everything that happened. Mainly, I didn't stick my neck out. We had a saying in camp, don't stick your ears out or anything out and do anything contrary to what the Japs don't like or do like. So that's what happened. And I didn't, you know, the Army term for seeking approval from a higher up. We didn't do that.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Anyway, we did what we had to do to survive. And you just take it day by day. I learned at Yokohama how little it takes to survive, to live, day after day. You need food. That's a question mark. You need a roof over your head. You need clothes to survive against the elements. And maybe friendship, there wasn't that much of it. But books or peace of mind that you could manufacture or whatever. That's about all you need. You don't need all this fancy living.
Well, and I imagine in all the years since, it's been almost 70 years since you were liberated, Am I correct in assuming that you haven't taken a whole lot for granted?
That's very true. When I got back, they inspected me, and they said, there's nothing wrong with you, so go home. So I went home, and I still had to, once every 6 months, go to the Veterans Hospital. First thing they do is hold your arm out. They'd take a needle and stick it in there. Well, they had some of the sorriest needle stickers I have ever seen. And it hurt so damn much, I said, I was getting 5%. I said, to heck with it. Take your 5%. I'm not coming back anymore unless I have to. I quit the VA hospital. But my main thing in life has been my completion of my degree with the GI Bill. I got my bachelor's degree in engineering. I never used it. I did a couple times. I stamped a few things, but I never sat at a desk and survived in that manner. I couldn't stand it. I want to get out in the open. I want to pour concrete. I want to frame houses. I want to build commercial buildings. I've built gymnasiums. I've been all over the state, built 36 homes up by the Veterans Hospital, and I helped my dad build 30 or 40 homes over here, FHA and GI, right here, just within a mile. And that is the most fulfilling thing. Work is the very best of all. There's no question.
Was it significant for you? Was it an emotional moment or a big deal to step foot on American soil again after all that time as a prisoner?
Yes, it was. When we were liberated from Sendai, we got on the train, and we got the same train that brought us down, and we went up to Yokohama train station. We'd passed it every day, twice. And there was American soldiers, officers, and nurses. We saw our first American nurses and workers and so forth. They sure looked good, I'll tell you. I shook hands with a one-star general. He congratulated me, and he became the president of the University of New Mexico State down at Las Cruces afterwards. But I cannot remember his name. I've been down there to some of the things that happened and ask him, who was president in such and such a year? I can't remember. And he shook my hand.
Well, since recording this interview, I had a chance to research that, and I've passed on to Bill that the gentleman's name was Hugh M. Milton II. He was actually president of New Mexico State starting in 1938, got recalled to active duty in 1941, and had been promoted to brigadier general shortly before that handshake Bill remembers overseas. Milton had reached major general before returning to Las Cruces in 1947 to resume his presidency at the university, and he later served as undersecretary of the U.S. Army during the Eisenhower administration. Quite a distinguished military career for General Hugh Milton. So that fills in the blank, and let's get back now to Bill Overmyer's memories.
Well, anyway, we got on a boat and went back to Manila, and we sat on the beach at Manila for a solid month. And well, where's the airplanes? We know there's a lot of you guys came over in airplanes. Can we go home in one? No way. Anyway, there was an issue of shoes, GI shoes, and I couldn't wait to get some good old American GI shoes. I put them on, and I got the worst athlete's foot I've ever had in my life. So they put me on medication. So every day I'd have to soak my feet in a pan of water that had potassium permanganate in it. I had never seen that before, but it was purple. And it was supposed to cure athlete's foot. Well, it took a month to cure it. That's how long I sat there on the beach waiting. Finally got on a Liberty ship and went home. And we had ice cream anytime we wanted it.
Well earned. Well, I know we've covered a lot. I'm sure there are many more stories you have, Bill, but I just want to make sure that I say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling me about it. You have something else on your mind.
One other thing.
Yeah.
When our ship landed in San Francisco, several of the guys looked at the beautiful white houses along the shore and said, you know, the United States didn't even know that we were in a war. They didn't suffer. Well, I know better now. I know they worked. Ladies worked at making things and all kinds of effort. But to see a house that never received a bomb or any machine gunning or anything else, you don't really know what the war is all about.
Well, and it's guys like you who were paying the price, so the folks back home didn't have to experience that. And you go all over the place, all over this state for sure. It functions for ex-prisoners of war, for survivors of Bataan and Corregidor. There's a memorial march at the White Sands Missile Range every year to commemorate the Bataan Death March. What is it that you want to keep alive? What's the history that you think your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids need to remember? What makes that so important?
When I was at UNM in the National Guard, and we went down to Fort Bliss, I looked one day at how many guys came from the University of New Mexico. And I've made some ridiculous statements, I think. I think half of the male population of the University of New Mexico was in the National Guard. And all of them were down there at Fort Bliss with me. Well, I know that hell ships killed a tremendous number of them. The Death March killed a bunch more.
And for folks who don't know, hell ships were the Japanese ships transporting prisoners, but oftentimes those ships themselves were sunk by American bombs. So a lot of Americans died unwittingly by American firepower.
Exactly. I can tell a story or two about those, but I will not. But to think that I firmly believe that less than half of our boys came home. In other words, we had a nominal 2,000 personnel. Half of that is 1,000 men. I believe there are anywhere from 900 to 1,100 of us died overseas. And that's a pretty big sacrifice. That's a pretty damn big mistake for the politicians in Washington, D.C. to allow a country get in such a bad state in the relationship with that country. Get so bad that they send us out on the spear of the sword and then take the sword away from us. It's ridiculous.
Well, and if you don't learn from history, you're bound to repeat it, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what it's all about.
Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you think it's important for us to know?
I can't think of anything at the moment. I appreciate the privilege of being able to do this. I'm sure the guys that I know, personal friends, my closest friends, that didn't come back, I'm sure they'd be grateful too. And that's the reason I do it.
To honor them.
Amen. Amen.
Wow. Don't you appreciate the candor? That is Bill Overmyer telling it exactly like he experienced it as a prisoner of war for over 1,200 days during World War II. You can find photos and some links to more information regarding Bataan, Corregidor, and some of the prison camps Bill spent time in at hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time this time, but I hope you'll listen in again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again, as Bill Overmyer knows all too well, freedom is not free.